Hey, ding-dongs, I'm Jamie.
I'm Richard.
And this is Explain It to Jamie, the political comedy podcast in which I, Jamie, a politically innocent but curious young man, have the complicated political happenings of the world explained to me by my political savvy friend, Richard Lamb.
But today, it's not just going to be me explaining things, because we're very, very excited to welcome two extremely special guests to the show. We have Mr. Anthony McMahon and Mr. Thomas McKechnie. Hello, guys.
Hey, how you doing?
Hello.
Do you want to say your name in your voice so that the audience can get that?
I'd rather not. Actually, I'd rather not be identified.
Okay. But, sure thing, Anthony.
Yeah. I'm very happy to be identified. Let's begin the class war now. I'm Thomas.
Yeah. Anthony and Thomas are very special friends of the show because they are, if you've been a listener for a long time, you'll know that we've mentioned them many times because they're kind of like our de facto fact checkers / research team. They're the guys who I always run things by before I say them on the podcast. They send me sources sometimes, and often they're the guys who say, hey, dumbass, you got this wrong. Anthony also, we have this kind of running bit about how handsome Anthony is and how nice his eyes are.
Yeah.
We actually have kind of an embarrassing fact to correct this week. Yeah,
this episode is going to double as a very a slight double dip.
Yeah.
We would like to double dip our opinion on Anthony's eyes.
It turns out Anthony's eyes are not crystal clear blue pools of mountain water.
Yeah, as we have oft described in various forms of metaphor.
They are, in fact,
green.
They're green. And it was Anthony, who has listened to every episode of the podcast, I believe, was too nice to say it to me himself. It was only when his girlfriend started listening to the podcast that she texted me to tell me his eyes were green.
That, or we have actually unearthed a deep psychological self a wish for himself that he had blue eyes and he just enjoyed hearing about it. Yeah. Anthony, can you comment?
Yeah, I think my eyes are green like the rolling fields of Ireland.
Yeah.
But I think you've identified them as blue like, I don't know, the Saint whatever's his name is cross in Great Britain. Saint
Mike. So you're saying you're a loyalist.
Yeah, I think you're trying to oat me as a loyalist. And when we do explain it to Jamie, the Irish conflict.
Yeah, the troubles.
I'll get much more offended and I'll put on an accent. But for now, I'll just let it slide.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. Thomas, any physical parts of your body you want to clarify for us right now?
No, I feel I've had no specific no parts of my body have been maligned on the show. And so if I am merely a mysterious angry voice in the void, I'm totally okay with that.
As you have been all along to us.
Great. Okay. Well, that concludes this double dip episode.
On to the normal episode. So, Jamie, what do you want to learn about this week?
I want to learn about, guys, are you ready for it? Communism. That's right. Pretty general, pretty big. Pretty big idea, I think, but I don't know that I have got a fair shake on what it is exactly, mm-hmm. and also how it's relevant now. I feel like in school I got to very, you know, this is what Russia is, this is what China is, and this is what communism is as it pertains to both those places, but I don't know that I actually got this is what Canadian communism is, or what, general Western communism is.
Sweet. Well, I feel like we'll all be happy to share equally in explaining to you what communism is. I think that it's gotten like a weird rap, especially for our generation. We're kind of like the very, very tip of the people who grew up without a major communist, like West versus East communist, like conflict on. Obviously, China's still technically a communist country, but yeah, Thomas is making like a gross lemon face right now. So like, it's true. They're really not a communist country. They're a fucking capitalist country that also like takes shit from its poor people. So, you know, they're not really a communist country anymore. And so because of that, finally, in our generation, in our adulthood, communism is becoming a lot less of a dirty word in the West, and people are starting, I mean, you know, communists never left the West, but people are starting to look at actually what the ideas are in a new way and think to themselves, wait a minute, this kind of could solve a shitload of the problems we're having. So I think it's resurging right now. We see that in America. We'll get into all this. We see it in America. We see it in other places. And let's get into what is it exactly and what is it not.
Okay, let me just slide on my political water wings as we dive into the conversation of communism. You ready, fellas?
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
Hold hands.
One, two,
three.
Explain it to Jamie.
boy, oh boy. It's a good thing that the theme song was there to catch our fall, for communism was not a pool ready to accept us, but just my hardwood floor in my bedroom.
No, I'm paralyzed now. Yeah. I can't walk anymore.
Yeah. What do you guys think of the theme song?
That's a great theme song.
I fucking love your theme song.
I especially liked dancing around to it in my red Speedo. I was also ready to swim in the pool of communism.
Yeah, yeah. I have to shout out that my girlfriend Jade is the voice on the theme song. Her and her two friends, her friends Kathleen and Emma. And Jade every time is like, why don't you ever credit me as being the voice of Explain It to Jamie?
So and now you have it, is. Jade. He has both credited you as well as addressed the fact that you wanted to be credited for.
Love you, dear.
It's a compliment and a shame the way that can only happen in relationships.
Yeah, that's exactly. Right. That's right. You've heard it here first, folks. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Jamie.
Yes.
What do you know about communism?
Mr. McCarthy, I don't know anything about communism. I don't know why I'm here.
No, we're all friends here. Just go on. Feel like you can really unpack.
No, Mr. McCarthy, I feel uncomfortable. I don't know that I should.
Listen, you motherfucker. You fucking queer communist bastard. You're going to jail.
Have you no decency, sir? Have you no after all of this, have you no decency?
Joe McCarthy sounded like Grover.
Right? Is that actually what he sounded like?
No, I don't know what he sounded like. That was a bit I was doing.
Sorry.
Also, I don't believe you would be queer if you're a communist, but Joe McCarthy definitely would have called somebody that.
Probably would have.
Just look it up.
Yeah, I guess I know what I learned in junior high, as I sort of mentioned, as it's associated with China, as it's associated with Russia. Communism is sharing, right? It's like an idea. It's the idea of shared work and labor and ownership of the companies that you work for.
Mm-hmm.
I think. That's what I think it is. And now, go! Yeah. Activate, you three!
Yeah, I mean, like, that's not wrong, right? Like, that's, at its core, that's, like, not a bad way to look at it. At its core, I mean, there's all kinds of ways to get into communism. Also, I mean, like, let me throw out the caveat right away. I am not an expert on communism. There are experts on communism. There are people who have like the most intensely well, like knowledgeable, like their facts are impeccable. Their dates are impeccable. They know every corner of the theory, and they're communists who are much like more well-read communists than I am. Mm. Right. So like, so I'm not one of those people. I'm going to get shit wrong. Please don't write me angrily on Twitter if I don't know which of Lenin's toenails was shaped like what, you know, Baltic state or whatever. Like, I know there are you guys out there who know that, and I respect you, but that's just not what I'm bringing to this. We're going to just try to explain the gist of it, I think, tonight.
Yeah.
Second middle toe looked like Estonia.
Yeah, obviously, I am not now, nor have I ever been a member of the Communist Party.
No, but no.
Absolutely, there's a ton of theory around it. There's entire schools of thought dedicated to it. Famously, the Frankfurt School was one. There was even some counterculture in the Chicago School, the University of Chicago, the birthplace of kind of neoliberal economics that runs the world right now. There's a big countercurrent there, and a counterculture in places like Oberlin and in Harvard and in CUNY and the State University of New York that really kind of tried to think about the world in a great way and tried to think about the world in a collective way that I have not done yet. But I've read a handful of them. I've read Communism for the Articles, I think, is what I'm
trying to say. Yeah. And communism inspires among the left like a lot of internal debate about what exactly it is and what it should look like, because it's never been realized in the form that it was originally conceived yet. People have made the attempt, but it's never gotten across the finish line fully, and maybe never will. You know, it's an interesting thing. Why don't we just start explaining it immediately? So,
so where did it? Maybe we start. Where did it start? Where, like,
right?
How did it, get traction at all in the first place?
Okay, so
who was involved?
Communism was first articulated by a dude named Karl Marx. Yes,
nailed it. Thank you, Mrs. Antonello. Yeah. Oh, she taught me that in grade 8.
Yeah, that's right. He was the dude among other achievements of his, are inventing glasses with a nose and mustache attached to them, and creating the letter grading system on report cards, and being half of the team that founded Marks and Spencer, the popular clothing company.
He was a busy dude.
He was actually a fantastic capitalist. He ran a great British department store.
Yeah, he was like the L. Ron Hubbard of like the mid 19th century. So Karl Marx was a German philosopher who kind of lived in Britain. And in Britain, in the middle of the 19th century...
Wow, okay. I just want to say, right away, you've blown my mind. I thought Karl Marx was Russian.
Oh. No, yeah. Interesting. No,
as an interesting thing, a part of... oh, God, we've already hit the Hitler part of this conversation. a big part of Hitler's push against communism was that Marx was a German Jew. And they're like, there is an inextricable link between German Jewry and communism. Oh, and so there was, that was part of the pushback against communism in the rise of fascism in Germany.
Okay. And Vladimir Lenin is a Russian.
He's Russian. Yeah. And he's the guy, he picked up sort of where Karl Marx left off.
That's right. was directly influenced by Marx. Although I believe generationally Lenin did not ever really meet Marx. He came just after Marx.
Yeah.
So Karl Marx wrote, oh God, what's the year? 1868? Question mark?
1848, I think. 48. The Communist Manifesto. Okay,
thank you, yes. Yeah. So Karl Marx was writing in the mid-19th century in Britain. And in Britain, he was witnessing the beginning of the Industrial Revolution firsthand, right? And it was... As he saw, you know, all of these massive factories being built, these new revolutions in like coal power and hydraulics and machines being able to like produce goods on this massive scale, he witnessed also the societal changes that were coming along with that. People relocating from the country into the cities, the conditions they were forced into the cities. Like, you're a dude who knows your Dickens. Like, you, and that's obviously the late 19th century, but like, you know, people in horrible poverty, child labor, no regulations on how long you were supposed to work, no holidays, no weekends, that stuff all came later, right? At the beginning, it was unvarnished capitalism, right? And a very select few people were getting extremely rich off of these people who began toiling in misery in industrialization. And Marx was seeing all this happening, and I think... I mean, and again, we're already into the territory where I'm extrapolating, and I don't know exactly. But there was, I think he just saw the immorality immediately of capitalism. He saw the immorality of these few people getting rich off of all of these poor people toiling in these factories for them, right? The people who owned the factories would get rich, and the people who worked in the factories would get shit all. And I think it was in exploring the morality of that he created the kind of ideological foundation for what became known as communism, and what he called communism.
Also, within that, one of the big things that Marx touches on, and one of the places where even if you believe that the free market is the solution to all the world's problems, one concept that is sort of just like irrefutably useful for maneuvering the world is his concept of historical materialism, which is the idea that anything that is happening in the world has a basis in what happened previously in the world. Huh. That, like, history, that we are constantly living in the results of history. And so, like, his background in history and philosophy, paired with the very lived experience that Richard was talking
about, that's where
these theories came from. Because it wasn't, like, he could no longer plug into, like, old Christian ideas of, like, oh, the poor are poor because God hates them.
Right.
Like,
right.
He was starting to look at the world through as a series of causes and effects. Yeah.
And he was the first guy who popularized the idea that people's economic circumstances determined, like, huge things about their behavior, their health. Like, basically, in his mind, the way you exist economically in the world as an economic unit essentially determined everything about your status in the world, how you could rise, what your life was like, right? He was the first guy to make that link in the mid-19th century.
Wow.
So he was like, you know, social science was created in the mid-19th century. He was one of the first practitioners of it in a lot of ways. And then also, so foundationally, we've talked about this in our Universal Basic Income episode, which you should listen to, but what he kind of zoomed in on, he zoomed in on many things. He has a very large body of work, and it's very dense and crazy, because he's a philosopher. He's a 19th century philosopher more than he's a 21st century economist, you know? Like, it's tempting to think of him like as the kind of economist you'd read in the paper or something. He's not like that. He's a lot more of a dreamer. He's a lot more like Nietzsche than he is like Paul Krugman, who writes for the New York Times, right?
Right.
He's like pretty fanciful, and he's not afraid to like dream mm-hmm. of right. a better world.
As I understand, communism is like a search for utopia.
That's right.
In a way, right? He and, was which is an utopia. Ideal.
That's right.
Yeah. And I don't know that I, you know, I think ideals are lovely, but I also think the, you know, realism gets in the way of that a lot.
Yeah.
And
well, kind of interesting on that point. There was a, we can say that socialism began with Karl Marx, but there was a great kind of history of social ideas that kind of came out of around the Enlightenment and the French Revolution. There were writers like, well, even St. Thomas More wrote a book called Utopia, and it was about a great land where people didn't have to work as hard, and everyone shared in the bounty of this incredible land. And then these 18th century French philosophers like Pierre-Joseph Proudhon started coming up with these ideas about how everyone could share equally. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Marx's great innovation, communism, was that this was actually what he called scientific socialism. So that in applying the principles of economics, the principles of moral philosophy, and the principles of economics, moral philosophy, and government, you could combine them and create a path towards a utopia. Which was the thing that differed him from like the Fourier and Proudhon and these kind of 18th century French utopians who just dreamed and wrote poetry all day.
Right. Now let's just right now take a sidebar and say socialism is like ideologies, is like an umbrella term for ideologies that involve sharing resources, and communism is a kind of socialism. So like, socialism is the larger term,
right?
Communism fits into that. You hear them kind of interchangeably used sometimes, right? Like socialist versus communist. They do have like technical. Am I wrong about
that? No, my understanding of it is that socialism is based on the state on state control. So the state owns the state, ergo the people owns everything, and profits from that ownership and like utilizes right. all of those means. This sort of shared ownership over everything allows people greater and greater freedom and greater control over their own lives, mm-hmm. which only grows exponentially because people, once sort of liberated from the material conditions of their existence, are able to take control of their own lives, able to say, like, no, I don't want this to be organized like this, or no, we shouldn't be building these kind of things, or no, or yes, we should be doing this, and mm-hmm. that this slowly dissolves the government's need to intervene and sort of, like, set things up and make things happen for people, and the people then sort of can do these things for themselves until eventually the state disappears, mm. and people in a sort of a small, in small self-regulating communities organize their own existence. For the mutual benefit of everyone, with everyone having an equal say in the operation of it.
Okay, so communism like the end point mm-hmm. of the socialism.
Mrs. Antonello, you know, I'm about to test what you taught me. I remember her talking about the political spectrum. You know, she was saying we often say left and right,
mm-hmm.
But actually, it's not. If you don't, you shouldn't look at it as a line, a clear line. You should look at it as an incomplete circle. So that as you go further left on the spectrum, you get eventually to socialism. And as you go further right on the spectrum, you eventually get to communism. But actually, socialism and communism sit right next to each other, but aren't connected. Correct, Antonello. Guys, how do you feel?
I've heard about that as the horseshoe theory a lot. Rather than socialism and communism, it's fascism and communism.
Yeah. Right.
And that was something that was espoused a lot, I think, in the 1940s by a lot of American liberals who believed that the American way was the correct way, the German way was incorrect, the USSR was incorrect. We're right in the golden middle.
And they were right. Right. And I will add, for Mrs. Antonello's benefit, it is very possible that she did say fascism and communism, and I'm only remembering through my own bias socialism yeah. and communism.
What, you mean you don't remember every single thing you learned in middle school, Jamie?
I remember barely what I did yesterday.
Who are you guys? Where are we right now?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember anything I learned in middle school right now.
I remember I had a teacher teach us about the French Revolution, and he was a Polish man named Mr. Mirza, and everything he described to us was in a nutshell, and he ended every sentence over the course of an entire semester talking about the French Revolution with, in a nutshell, Robespierre did this. In a nutshell, Napoleon then did this. And he would go on an entire class and say, in a nutshell, 45 times.
That was a very, very prolific nutshell that he and everyone else lived in.
He had a whole orchard of nuts.
In middle school, I learned that I was a queer.
I think we all learned that day.
Oh, good times.
Good times. Okay.
Guys, I wish we'd go back to middle school.
Never, ever would I.
Okay, so let me zoom all the way back for a second.
Mm-hmm.
So Karl Marx, we talked about this in our Universal Basic Income episode. One of the things he talks about is how, one of the things he came to believe is that doing labor is a fundamentally human thing. When you perform an activity, when you do labor, when you make a shelter, when you hunt an animal and cook it, when you pick food, pick berries and eat them, there's like something very, just the fundamental essence of humanity is like doing tasks to sustain yourself and for your own pleasure and your own enjoyment and your own survival. There's like something right about that. And when you're in a capitalist system where you're working for a wage, part of the problem, the thing that happens is that you are performing labor and you're being compensated with a wage, but your wage is always less than what your labor is worth, right? Because there has to be some surplus left over for somebody to profit from your labor.
Right. The company needs to make money.
Exactly. And because the company is making money, a certain amount of your like human labor is just bleeding away from you all the time, and you become, what Marx used the word alienated. He's like, he says you become alienated from your, in the translation I read, it was like species being. It's like your, that's like your soul. Like that's really what he's kind of talking about. But soul had a, you know, super religious connotation that it has sort of lost a little bit in our modern age. You lose some part of your fundamental humanity when you, when you don't enjoy your own labor.
And I think I would expand on enjoy, not just like in, like you don't have to enjoy being a coal miner, but if you, if everything that you do as a coal miner, that all of that profit goes to you, if you are compensated for everything that you do, then you enjoy the fruits of your labor.
If you spend weeks on your spare time building of like a fence for your house, when you're done the fence, that's your fence.
Right.
And it's like, even if it's fucking hard ass work, it's satisfying. And there's something like fundamentally human about creating things and producing things and doing tasks and doing labor. Mm. But if you're like a contractor for a huge like construction company and you're just driving around building fences for whoever, you're just like mindlessly building fences. You don't get to enjoy the fences. You're being paid a wage. The fences mean nothing anymore. And suddenly you're spending all of your time doing all of this labor, and you're not profiting from it in a spiritual way. Like that's what he kind of comes down to with Marx.
Okay.
There's like a, it's a philosophy thing, you know, it's not a economic thing at this point.
I was gonna say, although now I feel like I should rescind right away, but I think like so effectively, if the wage justifies the work. But we're not talking about economics, is what you're saying.
There's no wage. If you're getting paid a wage, you can never get a wage that's fair. Because if somebody's profiting, that means the actual value of your work, you're always making less than it.
Mm-hmm. The best way I've ever had this explained is, at a certain point in every workday, you start working for free.
Right.
That like you, like if the company wants to make $200 off of you, and you get paid $100, halfway through your day, you're working for free.
Right. So, yeah, okay, I understand that.
Right. And as long as that's the case, on some level you're aware of that.
Right. Now, there are companies that offer, you have to, these are specialized jobs usually now, but there are companies that offer stock options for your wage. Does that fall into your, this web of like, if you're, you know, you are making a wage which is less than what your work is worth, but also on a yearly basis you're being given options to buy into the company that you yourself are working for, so you are benefiting directly from your work. Does that fall into this?
I think it maybe does, but in any company that's obviously making a profit in a capitalist market, the way Marx would conceive of it, you're never getting a stock option that's worth your actual share of the company, right?
Right, right.
You know, that's right. You're getting maybe 5,000 stock or something like that that you can buy out at a certain amount, but there's still 100,000 or 200,000 shares of the company floating around for shareholders to make a profit off of the workers.
You don't have a share of the company that is proportionate to the labor you performed for the company, right? It's very unlikely that you have that.
But to make a really quick jump from what you're proposing to communism, yeah, if you have a 20th of, one 20th of the shares of a 20-person company.
Like then you're in communism.
That's communism.
Right. Like, you just have, that's communism.
Like, you know, your percentage of the company is yours. And then you're like, yeah, then 100%. Then you are working with a group of people for everyone's benefit, and you derive, unequal percentage of that benefit.
Yeah, and that's, let's go into
so
that.
So most, Silicon Valley startups start as communist.
Yeah, the three dudes at the table who agree to split everything. But you know what? Even in those cases, often there's disproportionate splits, right? And maybe if everyone agrees that that's fair to the proportion of labor, at those moments, those guys are in the communist ideal for a little bubble, right? Obviously, they still exist and they're inside a deeply non-communist world. So there's a kind of a meme phrase buzzword that's like, there's no ethical consumption under capitalism, right? You can't ever be like, oh, I bought this thing and this is good. This is a good thing I bought, and it's like there's no oppression in this thing at all. In that moment, those people are the. The problem with the Silicon Valley model then is that the whole point of those companies is that they're trying to get bought, right? Right. At that point they become, and then they hire people for salaries and for wages and stuff like that. And at that point, they become the capitalist class. They become the kind of the bourgeoisie, right? Which is a word that you've probably also heard associated with communism.
Yeah,
yeah. So Marx zoomed in on this middle class who's not like the bourgeoisie, like the upper class, the people who profit from all of these, for the people who own factories, the people who profit from other people's labor as the problem, and. Again, this is the Coles Notes explanation, but basically said that those people needed to not exist anymore. and Marx's only solution that he could understand was revolution. Now remember, he's writing 50 years after the French Revolution, so revolution is in the air. Every nation in Europe was terrified of revolution.
It's a real possibility.
It is a super real possibility.
Yeah.
It is very much a thing that could happen anywhere.
Right. And what's interesting about the revolutionary thing to me is that Marx thought communism was definitely going to start in Britain.
Yes.
And then spread to Germany and then some other places in Europe and eventually to Russia. Because Russia was too culturally backwards in Marx's view. That they were still serfs. They were they're not still serfs. They're only recently emancipated serfs at that point.
The Tsar and people giving mountains for princes' birthdays and stuff like that.
There was no way that they could sort of organize themselves into an effective socialist government. Mm-hmm. So that's where the interesting part of that's part of what shaped the idea, the sort of modern idea of communism and of socialism, is this place that Marx thought could never be, so could never arrive at socialism first, became the first one to try it.
That's right. Mm.
And so what's interesting about that is that when Marx was writing these books, Russia was actually still a feudal society when he first started, when he and Engels first started, and Western Europe was a capitalist society. And Marx thought that capitalism was amazing, right? In that it was the first ever system to strip morality out of economic systems. Because feudal societies and slave societies, which he talked about, were actively immoral ways of conceiving the world, right? You either conceived that some people, he talked about how the slave trade was taking black people and ridding them of their humanness, or the serf society was saying that serfs were less human than their lords, whereas capitalism said that everyone is human. And he thought that communism was the next step beyond capitalism, and so only a capitalist economy could become a communist economy, because communism was saying everyone's human and we have to activate that. And we have to make it so that people are actually equal, not just theoretically equal.
That's right. Mm. Yeah, capitalism. I mean, and you see this all over the history of the West now. Like, capitalism is an unstable equation, right? It has all of these core beliefs that are not followed through on in society, and those have always been, like, the problems. You know what I mean? Like, when America split off from Britain and wrote into its Declaration of Independence, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal," all of a sudden they had a problem. They instantly had a fucking problem, right, in their country. And it was an unstable equation that needed to resolve itself, and it continues to be unresolved to this day. You know, like the slavery thing. Yeah. Like, the fact that they were a country that said, you know what, our founding principle is that everyone's created equal, and then they also had slaves in their country, the instant the ink was dry on that thing, they were in trouble. And they knew it. They all knew it from the beginning. Anyway, that's a digression.
Right. Wow. Okay. Yeah. So Karl Marx, German philosopher, like pseudo-economist.
Economy was not real. It was only starting to become a school of social science.
Economics. So. Like, helped create one of the founders of modern economics. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely an economist.
So he's an economist A number one.
He's an economist the way that a dude in 1848 was a doctor when he was, like, leeching people and, like, cutting ankles off and shit. You know,
like, he was suggesting he was
that was a doctor. Yeah. That's a doctor, like, in 1848.
If I time traveled back to 1848, I'd be qualified for any job literally yeah. that came across desk.
Absolutely.
Cool. Yeah. Cool. Just because I read the internet for, like, more than
Dr. Jamie Kavanaugh, Esquire.
Oh, baby, I don't mind that. I don't mind. My mom loves that.
I think that's the plot of, Black Knight with Martin Lawrence.
That's right.
I was wondering when we would get to that seminal communist text.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so he's German, a philosopher, economist, came up with this idea, and it took off in Russia, which he didn't foresee happening. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Now, Russia and China are quote unquote communist.
Right.
Right.
Not anymore. Russia's not a communist country anymore.
Okay.
China. In theory is. In practice, it's an oligarchy with a lot of capitalism.
China has actually worked themselves out the sweetest fucking deal in the world, where they have the absolute control that communism allows, or that socialism allows, but also have the unlimited dynamic potential of capitalism. It does mean killing lots of people, but they really have to get, they've got that thing locked down.
Right.
Economically, a lot of people talk about China working as a mercantilist economy rather than a free trade economy. So China's economics are more similar to something like 16th century Venice than they are to 20th century America. And that's not really, I think, being glib. Like, they set export tariffs, or import tariffs, but they don't set export tariffs. So China can export things really cheaply, but they don't allow people to import things. And they play around with their currency at a state level in a way that can actively control how wealthy people in the country are. And
not just in the country. Like, they fuck with the destinies of all sorts of other countries based on how they will, like, depress or inflate their currency to build or sink other nations that they're in relation to. Like, they... Yeah, mercantile.
Wow. It's basically like a very small group of people using a billion other people as a huge gold Rolls Royce.
Right.
Like, that's what China is at this point.
So I guess the sort of point I'm trying to angle in on is, who are the communists? Mm-hmm. Where are they?
They're in fucking Kurdistan.
Is there a significant area of land with a significant group of people that are actively being communists?
According to all my family members, it's every single university.
Downtown Toronto.
Yeah.
Every CBC building.
If you see someone on a bicycle, they're definitely a communist. If you're drinking a latte, they're a communist. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the obvious thing, that we have talked about this also in our ISIS episode, in Rojava, in Syria, which is the Kurdish part of Syria, there is a fully communist state. That's probably, that might be the, like, clearest one on Earth right now.
Yeah.
Like, that, they're like, we are communists, and also, like, here's your house and have some food. You know, like, that's what will happen if you show up in Rojava. That's the clearest communist state. There's places like Cuba that are, like, nominally communist. Yeah, Venezuela.
I heard that when Greece was really, like, in the dumps, like at sort of the base of their barrel, that they had set up an economic system in which people had units of work and whatever. So like if I'm a farmer and I farm, you know, 500 units of wheat, I can put those, I can trade you 2 units of wheat for 2 units of car repair or whatever. And I'm a car repair man. Mm-hmm. And so I need these 2 units of wheat. And now I can trade these 2 units of wheat to this person. So at the end of the day, you just write a bill for like, this is who you need to send my units of wheat to. And this is who you need to send my units of, clothes making or whatever it is.
Like too. Labor vouchers.
Right? Yeah, effectively, yeah.
That was an idea that was tossed around in a lot of communist circles, and I think it was really briefly introduced in Russia at some points, in scarcity, but generally I think it's only been applied in really small micro-states.
Yeah, and like I said, it was I remember reading about it when Greece was, like, in the heap of their shit. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was sort of a last, you know, they're not importing anything, they're not producing anything they need right. to just need to use what they're making.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the big things that is one of the reasons that you don't see more communist or socialist countries in the world is quite literally because the Americans keep killing them. That like on like untold occasions popular leftist uprisings in, especially Latin America, but also in Africa.
Not just uprisings, like elections.
Elections, like straight up like, democratic elections. Yeah. The Americans will just swoop in and kill them. Salvador Allende in Chile and things like this.
That's the classic example.
There are all sorts of countries where they're moving towards these social experiments, and then you move towards these social experiments, and then the sometimes democratically elected leader of the country ends up dead, and the CIA was very busy at that time. Right. And so you don't see, there aren't a lot of nations that are currently practicing, structurally socialist countries, but there's also, you know, as Marx would say, a historical materialist reason why there aren't a lot of countries that are practicing socialist or communist ideas.
Huh. So when we talk about these countries like the USSR and China degrading back into a capitalist society, that's something that a lot of theoretical communists will call revisionism, where they will erase the past to try and return back to capitalism. And Joseph Stalin wrote a text called Socialism in One Country, where after the USSR had expanded all the way into the Warsaw Pact, so that's Poland, Czechoslovakia at the time, Hungary, it had also gone into Kazakhstan and a couple of countries in the Caucasus, like Georgia and modern-day Chechnya. He wrote this text called Socialism in One Country, which meant that we're finally big enough that socialism will stay around forever because we occupy so much of the world and so much of the world's population. And we saw how that turned out.
Right.
Yeah. Every other serious socialist text has said that there's one thing that capitalism is unfetteringly amazing at, and that's in keeping capitalism going. Mm-hmm. Even if it starts sinking, even if people start dying in some portion of the world because of lack of access to goods, capitalism will manage to destroy alternatives to itself. And that's why most communists talk about global revolution and the need for permanent revolution and socialism in every country. It needs to be a global program.
Right. Yeah. Well, I wonder, like, I you know, I'm a pretty idealist fella, and I don't feel out of sorts saying that amongst you three. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if, there are... Again, correct me if I'm wrong, but there are like socialist elements to our own systems. Like our healthcare system seems to me pretty like, you know, everybody pays in, everybody gets equal amount, non-discriminatory. What you're sick with, we like they'll treat. Mm-hmm. Totally. Is that the way? Like, you know, it seems far-fetched to me to be like everybody in the world has to change their mind at once. In order to succeed, or is it more of a creep, you know, of a, we'll socialize, you know, the fire department and police, and we'll socialize the hospital system, and we'll socialize with the UBI, and so
what you're like, talking about is a great question, and it's a very interesting question. There's lots of like people, like even in Russia, there were people who wanted incremental change and people who wanted revolution. The people who wanted revolution were called the Bolsheviks. You've probably heard of them.
Yeah.
The people who wanted incremental change were called the Mensheviks. And this is actually Lenin who named them. And he named the Bolshevik in Russian just means like the majority. And Mensheviks means minority, except the Mensheviks were actually like a numerical massive majority. But he just like did this brilliant thing where he was like, we are the majority people. We want the revolution. You minority. minority people don't get it.
Public relations guy, yeah. guy that Lenin. Yeah.
It's an interesting. It's always been the question. The thing is, capitalism is very good at resisting any alternatives to it and absorbing any alternatives to it, and at derailing any like honest chances to affect it. And I mean, the classic thing is that in our system, in Canada, in the U.S., the levers of power are massively controlled by capital, by people with a shitload of money who have a huge stake in continuing to be allowed to make a shitload of money and not have their money taken to like benefit everybody else. Like, you know, the simple question that you said in our UBI episode, which is like, why isn't there a maximum wage? You know, people are pitching that. Mélenchon, the guy who was like the Bernie Sanders in France,
yeah,
he pitched a 95% tax bracket after 400,000 euros. So if you make 400 grand a year, after that, we're 95% taxing every dollar you make.
Right.
Which seems like not unfair on some level, right? It's like you have a shitload of money. You
still be exorbitantly wealthy.
But like, you know, the several thousand people who that affects tend to be the people who are at Justin Trudeau's fundraiser. They're the people who talk to the politicians, mm-hmm. and who give those politicians money, which they use to stay in power. And that's a cycle that keeps capitalism alive and resists incremental change. The few times we've had massive social programs have been kind of like outliers. They've been exceptions. And there's no evidence that things are quietly stepping towards a more social system. And like in our lifetimes, the world we live in is way less socialist than the one our parents lived in. You know, mm-hmm. like our world is a lot more cutthroat and diehard, and we've lost a lot of the social protections and stuff that they used to have.
And you look at, like, I come from the West as well, right? I come from Saskatchewan.
We all come from the West. All four of us are Canadian Westerners.
We're not these downtown, like, Toronto, these yuppie
communists.
We're real.
Riding.
We're real salt of the earth types here. I'll explain it to Jamie.
So in Western Canada, in Saskatchewan, we had a quote-unquote socialist government with the CCF back in the 40s, 50s, and early 60s. Mm-hmm. And they introduced the first medical care program in Canada that became our Medicare that we know and love today. But it's also in Saskatchewan that my good buddy Bradley Wall, our current premier, is trying to reintroduce private healthcare back into the Canadian conversation. Mm. And he's actually doing a pretty good job of it, and he's managed to tear down little bits of this wall about this great Canadian idea that healthcare is a right.
Wall?
Hey.
Kill yourself. Yeah. So like we're backsliding. Like the minimum, like things about how like the minimum wage doesn't keep pace with inflation anymore.
Right.
You know, things like our labor regulations have eroded, like mm-hmm. like unions are eroding, things like that. These are all steps backwards into more unregulated capitalism, because capitalists have succeeded at lobbying the government to get them the things that will make them more money at the expense of everybody's well-being. That just keeps happening.
Well, to quote Ian Malcolm from Jurassic Park, life will find a way.
Yeah.
And to back that up, I wonder, sometimes I think the 18-year-old punk rock version of myself is like, fucking let it burn. You know, if it takes getting further away from the ideal that I want to for everybody, the masses to wake up, mm-hmm. is that actually progress? You know, cancel me out. But like, if the, you know, the wage gap gets so big that eventually 60% of the population cannot deny the fact that 60% of the population is living at a far, far lower quality of life than the top 10%, then isn't that actually a benefit?
I mean, and that's what happened in Russia. Like, let's mm-hmm. go back there. In 1917 in Russia, the Tsar had committed Russia to World War I, which was, like, so unpopular. Like World War I was, you know, a fucking... Obviously, you know a lot about it. It was a fucking butcher show, right? Like, it's like people were just getting fucking massacred, and people already were pissed at the Tsar, and there was a lot of unrest forming, even before World War I started, about how wealthy the elite of Russia was and how poor the peasants were. They were still like peasants in Russia at this time. It was still feudal, right? It hadn't industrialized, like the guy said. So it was those conditions. It was like every single person in the country knew somebody who had been shipped off to the war and was getting fucking killed. And there was no food because of the war. And there are all these rich people driving around in their fucking carriages. That was the conditions in which revolution finally happened. And it's worth saying, the first revolution in Russia was not a communist revolution. It was like a military coup, basically, right, to kick the Tsar out because he had overcommitted to World War One and was so removed from the people that he was just basically going to destroy his whole country for the sake of being in this European war. And it was only once the February? That was the first one?
February was the first.
February Revolution in 1917 happened, that the communists, who had been trying for decades to start a revolution, they saw it happening. A lot of them weren't even in, like Lenin had fled to Germany by that point. He was hiding because he was, you know, like a wanted criminal in Russia. Lenin cut a deal with the people who took over, like in the midpoint, to come back to Russia after they revolted, and then the communists took over a couple months later in the October Revolution. That was the real communist revolution. Mm-hmm. So it was only once everything was all fucked already. They need to come up with
more creative names for the revolution. Say that right now. Yeah. Like, well, what day is it?
Yeah. Revolutionaries like scientists are bad at naming things.
Right?
Like,
oh man, have you ever heard of the like French Revolutionary calendar?
No.
So it's French, great. So one of the like crazier things that they tried to do after the French calendar was like they tried to do the metric system for like the calendar. So, you know, the calendar.
You mean not named after Norse gods?
Yeah, that's right.
But also, like, not having a totally random number of days. Like, every month was like
10. Everything was tens. Yeah. It was metric, right? So it was like every month had 30 days and every week had 10 days.
Right.
And every single day was named in the whole year. So, like, it was like, this day is plow day. It was all named non-secular stuff, right? It was all named after, like, farm shit and, like, and
stuff like of trees. The people. Yeah. But also, like, corresponding to the seasons. Yeah. It was like, Thermidor was like
the
May,
summer. No, it was like the summer. It was August? Hot. It's like July was Thermidor.
Right.
But then it was like, Plumer was like April because it was rainy, you know, like shit like that.
Well, let's take a little break from all this talk. I like this kind of conversation. The Aztecs, one of the reasons they were so good at math is they counted to 20 on each or 10 on each hand because they counted their knuckles as well.
Was it 12? Was it each? One, two, three, four.
Yeah, I think so. Something like that.
A base 12 math system.
Yeah. And so they're like, and that's one of the reasons they were so far beyond other feudal nations.
See, I just thought it was a racist stereotype that all Aztecs are good at math and are terrible drivers. But
no, or like keyboards. Keyboards are designed to slow you down while you type.
Yeah. Really?
They're the most ineffective way to type. They're designed to slow down because you learn to type on typewriters. And typewriters have those little metal things shooting at the page all the time.
Right.
And so if you're too good, they get stuck. And so they're actually designed to be an ineffective way to type, which is why stenographers use a different keyboard.
But now they're just... Just
like you can't reteach the entire world how to use the new better keyboard.
Honestly, though, but I'm amazing, and I went, you know, I lived in a foreign country for a year where they have a different keyboard.
As QWERTY? Or?
Yeah, it's like a different. It's like everything's in a different place, and it was deeply traumatizing to start using it. But in the end, I actually could use the keyboard, not as fast as the QWERTY keyboard, but I could use it.
Yeah, I forget what it's called. There is the most effective keyboard in the world. Couples all the vowels together.
Dvorak
is a composer.
Yeah. No, Dvorak is a composer. Dvorak maybe is the keyboard.
I believe you. Circling this all the way back to socialism,
yes,
is that I think to me this is why I'm like a pretty outspoken anti-capitalist, is because something like a better use of a keyboard, capitalism is never going to come up with, because there's no practical benefit in everyone like being able to type better. No, sorry, capitalism will come up with it when it benefits capitalism.
Right.
But there are so many things in our lives that are good and healthy and essential that capitalism cannot monetize, and so it has no interest in.
Before we jump too far from that, I want to reincorporate the Charles Dickens thing you said earlier, which is, as an exercise, do you know why his books are so wordy and so long?
Were they serial? Was he paid by the word?
He was paid by the word. He wrote in serial for newspapers. So, so he would draw those babies out as long as he could.
How long can I talk about this misery?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Totally. And then therein is another, capitalism does not necessarily make you the best story.
Right?
It makes you a very, very long story with thousands of characters called Mrs. Wimblebottom and
that's the problem with capitalism. It is a totally amoral belief system. It is a belief system, but its only values are growth and profit, right? If something is profitable and if you can grow it, it deserves to exist under capitalism. And that means we get the dumbest shit in the world sometimes, right? And you get all this crazy, all these resources used on things that don't matter. Used on things that, like the Juicero, it's the classic example, which is this Silicon Valley $400 juicer that cold presses juice for you in a proprietary bag of fruits and vegetables. So you can't just buy fruit and put it in this fucking juicer. You have to buy their bag of fruit and put it in the juicer. But also, they figured out that you can just squish the bag of juice with your hands and the juice comes out. You don't need the juicer at all, right? So these millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of venture funding went into this fucking company.
Right.
And
we were talking about Lyft and Uber. You have two companies who are actively competing with each other, trying to do almost the same thing.
Right, and the theory is that that competition will produce the best solution, right, for everybody. That's the good of capitalism, is because there's competition, somebody's going to figure out the best way, and that way is going to win, and then we'll have this great solution. But we've seen, with all the focus on United Airlines, the airlines just divided America in four parts, the four major airlines, each of them took a part, and none of them compete anymore.
Right,
and they just fucking laugh at our misery, drink mugs full of our tears, and live on a private island.
Like an oligarchy? Monopoly?
Oligarchy.
Yeah, I believe it's called an oligopoly.
Fucking oligopoly. Killing it. Since 1988. Which leads me to another question. I've often wondered why, once a company reaches that level, like an oligopoly, as you just said, why doesn't it then become public? For a company like the Alphabet Corporation that is never going to crumble. It's the Rome that will never burn because it owns so much stuff. Why doesn't that? Why doesn't the government? And I understand it being impossibly expensive. And then
guillotines are involved.
But why doesn't it just become public? If we go, okay, we won the game. We won the game on airlines, and it's not moving. Delay of game penalty. This belongs to the government.
I'm sure the actual reason is that the people who are making the money pay the people who make the decisions to let them keep making money.
And I would
that's
say
that's gotta be it.
To expand upon this is a thought that Richard brought up earlier, which is it's not only fundraisers and backroom deals and bags of cash slid under doors that allow capitalism to continue to be continue to enforce its will on major governing bodies. Mm. It's also the fact that massive corporations control almost all of the media. So almost all of the information that people receive comes through the lens of people who want capitalism to continue.
Right.
Because everything is owned, every force that is exerted can be exerted in favor of capitalism.
Right.
And so the great example of that is you look at Great Britain. Private companies built all the railroads, and after the English government saw how much of a function the railroads provided for the country, they just bought them all and nationalized them. And they ran them perfectly, and everyone liked the railroads pretty much. And then when Margaret Thatcher came in, she was a capitalist ideologue and said, these should be private. And she privatized them. And then all of a sudden they were it was an oligarchy. It was an oligopoly again. Mm-hmm. So everyone owns their little slice of railroad, and now the railroads in England are terrible. And so the Labour Party, who's the quote-unquote socialist party in England,
talks about, well, let's just nationalize them again. They should just be nationally publicly owned. Huh. And we have a microcosm of that in Canada with CN Rail that was privatized. And we have...
doesn't Bill Gates own most of CP?
Is it CP? Yeah.
I think so. I think he does.
Actually, I would believe that if you said that.
Joke? That's not a joke. I don't think it's a joke. I think
Bill Gates owns most of one of the Canadian rail companies?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Oh, in fact, actually, here's a fun anecdote. I had to take the train from Edmonton to Toronto because I had just had surgery and I wasn't able to fly, but I had to be back in Toronto. And it's
by
one
the
of
way,
those...
your cybernetic eye is really...
It's
looks
really
great
good.
Tonight.
It's
yeah.
so good.
It's a good
so
cybernetic good. Eye,
You're not just
man.
Saying that.
No.
Okay.
I've been thinking for a long time. I've been wondering if I should say
I did bring this story up only for compliments.
Yeah.
But, what you know, the train ride, which if you at home are thinking about taking it, I would advise maybe don't. It's like yeah. painful. I had just had surgery on my face, but also... And I didn't have a sleeping car, but also it was a long time and no Wi-Fi and... Anyway, but every time the train, like, so the train is driving, and the train has the capacity to drive at, like, 180 kilometers an hour, let's say.
Yeah.
But because freight trains use the same way, and they max out at 50 kilometers an hour, and the passenger train is renting space from the CP, it's not actually, you know, Bill Gates doesn't give a shit about whether I get across in a timely fashion or not. You always have to pull off to the side
right.
and let freight trains go by, and there's no point going faster because you're always going to catch a freight train.
Right.
Yeah.
Ugh. So fun fact.
Do we want to make this a whole podcast about trains?
Yeah.
Because if not, I can cut this in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I do the commute between Montreal and Toronto a lot, and the reason behind that is that Via Rail and I guess it was Canadian Pacific were both owned by the same company.
Hmm.
They were both owned by the Canadian government, and I think it was Brian Mulroney's government wanted to sell them to try and buff up the budget a little bit because they were running kind of structural deficits at that point. And they offered both of them up for sale, and all of the private companies said, well, passenger rail is never going to make a profit, so you guys can keep that, but we'll buy up all the railroad and all the freight. And that just kind of shows that capitalism has no interest in the public good, right?
No.
We were using freight to subsidize passenger rail because passenger rail was seen as a public good and freight was seen as a productive good.
Mm.
But capitalism only wants production. It does not want public good.
Mm. Here's an analogy that I independently came up with, although I know that it's probably been come up with before and I don't claim to be the first person to think this up. Capitalism to me, it's like fire. Like, its place in the development of human history is undeniable, and its power is undeniable. But you do not want everything to be on fire, even if fire is a good thing in certain situations,
right?
And you want, you need fires to be controlled, and you need the ability to put them out, and you do not need them to, you do not want fires to be able to replicate themselves unbidden, with like uncontrollably.
Right.
And capitalism, I think, is the same way. Like, the power of competition in a market on a small term is unbelievable. And I believe in organicity. I believe in spontaneous people trying to find the correct solution to a problem that society has and competing to find the best solution and finding the best solution. But then I believe in snuffing the capitalism out in some way, you know, like putting it out once this, like you said, you won, you're public now.
Yeah.
Like, we need that mechanism, but we don't have it at all. Right.
Right. And okay. I'm sorry to cut you off.
No.
I'm wondering, because this is very quickly becoming not a communist podcast, but a anti-capitalist.
But the thing about at the moment, communism's really the only clear alternative to capitalism that we have.
Great,
right?
Which leads me to my question, right. I don't necessarily want to get away from that because I'm enjoying this, but I think, I wonder, if not capitalism, we clearly in the room agree that the communist values are an asset. What is there anything else on in that swing that is an alternative, or is it capitalism or communism as far as
like
this room
anarchy?
Is concerned?
That's a whole other thing. But Antony has a great line, which is not his, but it reminds me of him, which is that social democracy is literally the left wing of fascism.
Social democracy is the left wing of fascism.
Yeah.
We haven't really talked about social democracy.
Yeah. I need you to delve into that a little bit. I don't know what you're talking about.
I can jump into this a little bit.
Great.
So if we're looking at that early question about do we want revolution, or do we want incrementalism? The great schism in communism was generally that, kind of sidetracking for a second, Marx was, as we talked about, a philosopher. He didn't lay out a roadmap to build communism. And the two great philosophers of communism or socialism were Vladimir Lenin, who we've talked about, who was a revolutionary, and a guy named Karl Kautsky, who was a German social democrat. And Karl Kautsky talked about how if you just implemented socialist ideas into a capitalist system, they would be so well loved and so respected by the public and so essential to the functioning of a good society that they would just slowly eliminate capitalism. And that was replicated in England in what was called the Fabian Society, which is where Labour grew out of, right? The Labour governments in England, who instituted the National Health Service and instituted all this nationalization of industry and labour standards across, basically, that were replicated across the entire world. It was the greatest growing of public good in human history was in Labour governments and in Scandinavian governments and in German governments. And this was the schism. So social democracy was this idea espoused, where you take these socialist ideas of public good inserted into an economic system, and they become so essential that they slowly transform it into something else. And that's what the NDP is here. They are a social democratic party, and there's a lot of social democrats across the entire world. A lot of communist philosophers, like Leon Trotsky, a famous communist in Russia. He was the head of the Red Army during the revolution, and then he was second in line, basically, behind Lenin to be the leader of the USSR before he was usurped by the bureaucracy and Stalin. He said that social democracy, this idea that you can just make a kinder capitalism that will slowly evolve into something good, was just a left wing of fascism. It was just a way to suppress communists, because communists were acting and asking for a greater, better world. Mm-hmm. And social democrats were saying, may you please give us a better world, and it will just cut off the revolutionary tide of the people.
Which is what we have now. Like, in Canada, there's not a lot of political will for revolution against capitalism, because people have so much material comfort, and they understand on some level that their material comfort is due to capitalism, right? So, like, you know, on some level, your clothes are being made by people who are paid nothing in Bangladesh, whose factories collapse on them and they die in the hundreds. You know, on some level, that the fact that your bananas are grown in South America and the, like, you know, the massive amount of fuel and resources needed to bring you bananas into your supermarket is, like, kind of a waste of resources to get you this one tropical fruit in the middle of winter in Canada. It's, you know, like, you understand these things, and yet you're hesitant to act on them. All of us feel this in the West, and that's the mechanism, exactly the thing that Anthony just talked about, right?
Well, and actually, I heard a story of there's this chef, celebrity chef, who went to some small village in South America and was getting, he was there to get sort of tips on local cuisine and stuff like that, and he brought them food from where he was, and, you know, and they came to love it. This, like, I forget what it was. I think it was candy or something. And he was walking around their village one day, and he found wrappers all over the ground and, like, in the bush. Mm-hmm. And he was, like, picking them up, being like, no, you can't do this. You know, you can't put it on the ground. And, like, why would you do this? And he realized in that moment that the only reason that it had happened in the first place was because he had brought it in the first place. So the idea that they're throwing it on the ground, and I think that sometimes when I see people littering on the street, is, you know, yes, it's disrespectful and it's irresponsible, but ultimately we have to assume that if you're creating this garbage, that some of it's going to end up on the ground. So the fact that it's being created in the first place is the immorality.
Even if Tim Hortons puts don't litter on the cups,
don't litter on the cups,
people still litter.
It's crazy. Yeah. And Tim Hortons has no impetus to create a biodegradable cup, right? Yeah. Like, they don't. It's not profitable.
Exactly.
And here we are again, right?
So it's easy to blame the people who are throwing the garbage on the ground versus the people that are creating massive amounts of non-biodegradable.
Here's an interesting point I want to make too. So Anthony very, very well defined social democrat just then, but another term you hear is democratic socialism, and they're different things, even though they're the same two fucking words in different orders.
English.
Okay. So democratic socialism is a newer idea. newer compared to like the Russian Revolution. And again, so rolling back to what Anthony said, Marx didn't leave a roadmap to communism, and that's part of that's basically the problem. All the bad shit you hear about communism came because the roadmap's not clear. One of the things that Marx did say is he said the middle step between capitalism and the utopian communism is there needs to be a dictatorship of the proletariat. That's the exact words he used, in which the proletariat, the working class, the farmers, the people who work in the factories, the people who do the work, need to rise up, revolt against the people who own all the shit, and then control society.
Right.
As a dictatorship. He was like, there needs to be the people who are the laborers need to control society as a dictatorship in order for us to create the mechanisms that will lead to communism.
Now, is that or is that not what Bane tried to set up yes. in the Dark Knight?
Oh, races? I was so fucking angry at the third Dark Knight movie. I was so fucking angry. Fucking Christopher Nolan is like, oh, this is what society needs. It's a big fucking fascist dickhead who just punches his way through all of the problems. Anytime all of the people get together and decide that they want their lives different, that's a problem because the masses are inherently evil. Yeah. Fuck that movie. Fuck Christopher Nolan.
Well,
I was born in the Russian Revolution. Yeah. You merely Googled it.
Yeah, no. Oh, so.
Oh, good. I'm going to use the Bane voice in this episode.
Yeah.
And I was wondering what would break first. Yeah.
We had talked about this, though, on one of our double dips. The reason Russia became a totalitarian dictatorship, the reason China became a totalitarian dictatorship, is because that's what they thought the plan was.
Right.
They wanted to create a better society. But then it turns out, once you create the mechanisms of a dictatorship, one asshole can ruin it for everybody. That's what Stalin did in Russia, and what Mao himself, the guy who architected it all in China, did in China. Right? Like, Stalin was a minor figure in the Russian Revolution. He was one of the, you know, leaders, but he like robbed banks to help the revolutionaries get money.
Right.
And he was not considered as smart or cool or talented as Trotsky and Lenin. But he was kind of, he thought he was the best one, and he displaced and murdered them all. Right. Like that's kind of what ended up happening.
That's interesting. I was reading this, and it's a short story. Anyway, long story short, the guy meets God, and God, over the period of this long conversation, reveals that the point at which humanity will be able to ascend to a higher level is when you have reached the security that you can put the world-ending detonator into the hand of each and every human being, and each and every human being refuses to press the button.
Right.
And I thought that was fucking interesting. And it's also frustrating, because thinking about now, you're like, there's no way in hell I would put that detonator in every human being's hand.
No.
at this moment. That shows how far we have to go.
We read 4chan, and now we now we're like, hell the fuck. Yeah.
Bury that detonator.
To get a bit poli sci for a second, that's the entire idea of what's called democratic peace theory, or mutually assured destruction in democratic peace theory, mm-hmm. where everyone does have the detonator, or at least enough people have a detonator, and
that no one's
chosen
use the
not to press them. But yeah. we're seeing right now in the world, there are two people who may have a detonator, and they may be really close to pressing them. Right.
Especially right. one dude who like gets all of his shit from whatever is on Fox and Friends, or whatever. Yeah.
And especially a guy whose entire house is made of gold.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Actually, I think both of their houses are entirely made of gold.
I was gonna say, are we talking about Donald Cheese Whiz Trump,
Kim Cheese Whiz Jong Un? I believe is the other two dudes we're talking about. No, but what I was trying to do was define democratic socialism. So right. Marx had this idea that you needed to have a dictatorship.
Mm.
But since we've seen what happened in Russia, what happened in China, socialists in the modern era have adopted this thing, democratic socialism, which is like, let's use the mechanisms of democracy, but have a socialist ideology. So like, the vision anymore isn't that we have a dictatorship and like murder squads and shit like that, but it's that you use the institutional mechanisms of a democracy inside the like kind of revolutionary aspects of emancipating capital, like emancipating the means of production from capital, like taking away people owning factories and shit like that. Everyone owns everything, but then also you still elect your leaders. There is still democratic accountability.
Tastes like mom's home cooking, but it's actually broccoli and vegan food.
Exactly. Yeah, right. You can't become a billionaire anymore, but you can still elect who leads you, and that person has to step down. Like, that's the new vision of the middle step.
And there's even an argument that, like, you can't really have democracy under capitalism, because so long as people's material conditions are sort of their most pressing concern, where it's like, if I don't work, I don't eat, I die. If I don't work, I, you know, not in this country, don't have healthcare, I die. Mm-hmm. Like, that you can't sort of, like, become a meaningful civic participant where you're like, I think this is what should happen.
Because free will becomes being like, polluted.
Exactly. Like, you're like, oh, we should do this because this will lead to me maybe having a job. Oh my God, can I please have a job?
You look at the United States, only 52-55% of people vote. The 48-45% of people who don't vote universally make under $30,000 a year, right?
Right.
So it's not a democracy. It's a democracy for people in the lower middle class / middle class and up.
Right.
Yeah. And rich people overwhelmingly vote and they overwhelmingly influence elections. So that's this idea that there's no democracy without socialism, actually. The democracy we have now is a half stage.
Yeah, because in socialism, you free people from the need to work to live. The fact that you have to work to live is a form of coercion and slavery, right? Like in our society, the fact that you have to go work for somebody in order to live, that's the way capitalism compels you to participate in it, right? But if you had, you know, the state providing you food and the state providing you a place to live, suddenly you're emancipated from all of that. Like, you don't need to work to live anymore. And that suddenly frees you up to do all kinds of other things. We don't know what that society looks like.
Right.
That society's never existed.
Can I just get in with a hot, sexy idea for a second?
Get in there.
So,
always feel free.
I know that, Jamie, you were talking earlier about this idea of people getting stock options, and we were talking about democratic socialism. And earlier I talked about the Scandinavian countries and social democracy. Well, one of the great philosophers and economists in Scandinavia, in Sweden, I believe it was a guy named Rudolf Meidner, who was the finance minister in Sweden for about 10 or 12 years in the 60s and 70s. And Rudolf Meidner came up with this idea called the Meidner Plan, wherein every job that was worked would receive a portion of the stock of the company every year. So you'd get your wage, and you'd also get a share of the profits. And basically Sweden has like a 70 or at this point I think 85-90% unionization rate, so everyone's a union member. So all the unions started collecting all the companies, and his idea was that over about 20 years eventually the business owners, who were these you know, entrepreneurs who had ideas and they were like, I see a market opening, I want to open a business, they got to open a business. And if that business started doing really, really well and hiring a lot of people, eventually the union would just take it over rather than someone's kid taking it over.
Right.
And so eventually the country would be composed of a whole bunch of unions running a bunch of good businesses. And the government would work with the unions to supply a good life for everyone in the country. And that was a wildly radical plan that was so cool and basically built Sweden and what it is today in a much truncated version. They obviously eliminated the 100% unionization over 20 years and things like this, but
there's so many things to get kind of like excited about. You know, when you start opening your mind to a system outside of a capitalist system, like think of a system, like we talked about the Alaska Permanent Fund and our UBI, which is a big, every company that did oil extraction in Alaska had to pay a certain amount of money into a big fund that's managed like a mutual fund. And if that fund makes interest, they just take the interest and give a proportion of it to every person who lives in Alaska. But like, think of if like the GDP of Ontario worked that way. Yeah. Think of like if Ontario makes money this year, everyone splits it. Yeah. Like the government gives you enough money for a house and for food, but then like if we as a huge collective make money, we split it. Like, and that is like, it's not quite, it is communism in the sense that everyone owns the means of production, but there's like a capitalist element in there. There's like a market element. There's a competitiveness element. There's an element of wealth, which is like, you know, and we haven't really even delved into that. We should probably start wrapping up, so we probably won't delve into it, but like, it's a much more communist world. Like, and there's something to be excited about that.
Well, like, I was going to say, it's like that What's the name of the author? The capitalist realism.
Yeah.
Yeah. About the
K-punk.
Mark Fisher. K-punk. Yeah. Mark Fisher. The fella in this book. The big thing I took from it, which is also like the main first thing, is the idea that we can't imagine a world, a better system than capitalism, so we refuse to acknowledge that a world like that could exist. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, we've fixed this thing. You know, it's the old argument. It's the best system we have, so we don't, why, you know, until we find a better one.
Wasn't it Winston Churchill who said capitalism
democracy
is the worst system ever?
Yeah, he's a real
fucking
piece of shit. Yeah.
Democracy is the worst system ever invented except for all of the other systems that have ever been invented. There's some horrible paraphrase like that.
Yeah, and capitalism can, but capitalism is a
king. Yeah, 100%.
You know? Yeah. But it is that denial, it is that, like, imprisonment of I can't imagine something better, or I can't imagine it working, or, you know, the idea that the whole world has to change all at once, or nothing, or it will never change at all, like that sort of like futile look at a mass system change. Well, And reluctance to accept that as a
possibility.
What's
funny is that history completely invalidates that opinion. And it has any historical event. Like in 1863, it was insane that Canada would confederate into one country, all of the provinces of British North America. That was not at all a mainstream political idea in 1863. But in 1864, boom.
Right.
All of a sudden, that deal was getting written down. You know, it took 3 more years, but like...
If we're going to talk about potentially misattributed quotes, like that, great Winston Churchill one, there's a great Vladimir Lenin quote that is, there are decades where nothing happens, and there are weeks where decades happen. And his idea was that the Russian Revolution, happened in 2 days.
Yeah. Right.
And that changed the entire course of the world. Yeah. Or, potentially the rest of time, or at least the rest of the next couple centuries. Right? And
as Karl Marx says in the Communist Manifesto, you better lose yourself in the music, the moment you want it, you better never let it go. Only got one shot, do not miss your chance to blow. This opportunity comes once in a lifetime, you better...
Guys, you know what? I'm filled with joy because usually this podcast ends with me wanting to know less. And this has ended with me wanting to know more. I feel inspired. I feel invigorated. A bit like the odds are set against me and what I want. Not that I don't know that I'm, I can like confidently say, I'm a communist. I am inspired by the sort of anti-capitalistic and more idealistic and socialist ways of looking at the world I live in.
That's sweet, man.
But yeah,
like where we're at, communism just shouldn't be a dirty word anymore. We're not fighting communism anymore. Like, that's not a part of our worldview in our modern time. But the thing that is happening is that capitalism is causing the climate crisis, right? Like, it's capitalism. We could have all our shit electric, and we could be not using oil at all, but oil companies have fought to stay alive. You know, like, we could have transitioned to an all-electric economy. Electric cars and oil-based cars were created at the same time, but electric cars were killed by oil companies because oil companies got there faster. But electric cars could have had hundreds of years, like 100 years of development by now. You know, they could be incredible.
Right.
And they're the ones that are finally starting to exist are there. But anyway.
But can you make electric cow farts? Let me tell that joke again.
Yes.
But can you make electric cow farts?
You can, but it's horrifying.
I thought you were going to leave it at just, you can, but...
Oh, that was that
sentence.
You ever see one of those like those things they have in like science centers? That's like a glass ball full of like purple lightning.
Yeah,
that's that's an electric cow fart. Actually,
yeah, that's what.
And the organic cow farm industry shut that down.
Those fuckers.
Oh, guys, I think it's time.
I think it's time.
We gotta call it. This has been one of my favorite episodes so far. I look forward to listening to it and sharing it. If you like this episode, please share it on your various things.
Share it freely. Don't profit from it. Share it with those who need it only.
That's right.
Take divide it, take an audio editor, divide it into equal chunks, and give a certain chunk of it to all of your family members.
Yeah, and actually, in listening to this, it belongs to you just as much as it belongs to us.
That's right.
So share it on Facebook, Twitter. We want more people to join in this conversation. We're having a great time making this podcast. Yeah,
any feedback, email us, explaintojamie@gmail.com, Twitter, @explainjamie.
Facebook, explain it to Jamie. I want to give a big
Twitter @RealDonaldTrump.
I want to give a huge thank you to our two guests, and also like huge already parts the two of the ecosystem of our
they're the unsung hosts of the podcast. Really, they've been such a huge part of us making this podcast. We're thrilled to finally have their voices on the air. So thank you guys for being here.
Yeah, Anthony and Thomas, amazing. Yeah.
And I don't know, where can we find you guys? Do you have Twitter? So do you have things that people want you to, you want people to look at?
I'm on Twitter at @postbrechtian. It's mostly politics and nonsense.
Yeah.
And I want to go back to the beginning of the podcast. You don't know my name. I don't exist. Yeah. I know I'm doing the show with two improv guys, and the first thing I said on this podcast was no.
Yeah. But you said no while also saying yes.
And with your eyes.
By God, those charming green
eyes. Forest green eyes. Emerald green eyes.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on the podcast, guys. Thank you for listening, you at home. Stay vigilant, stay active, stay connected, share, and we'll see you next time.